From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, 55 years ago today, WUWM went on the air. A lot has changed since September 9th, 1964. We'll talk with the station's first general manager, Dr. Rue Hill, about where the station started and what we've become.
I try to be modest about it, but I'm so proud. It's just great. I knew our goal was solid, to be a community service.
And we'll chat with WUWM's longtime news reporter and Morning Edition host Bob Bach about the appeal and necessity of public radio.
To this day, public radio, and WUWM in particular, it's a beacon. I mean, if you have a yearning to hear the real deal, this is where you want to listen.
Join us on Lake Effect as we celebrate 55 years of delivering the real deal after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. A lot of things happened in 1964. In the United States, the landmark Civil Rights Act was signed into law. The Ford Mustang automobile was introduced. U.S. postage stamps cost 5 cents. The U.K. gave Malta its independence, exported Beatlemania to the world, and established the world's first pirate radio station, Radio Caroline. Well, 1964 was also when another radio station came on the air, this one. On September 9th, 1964, WUWM, which is very much not a pirate radio station, but a service that was put into place by the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin system, began broadcasting. And one of the key people responsible for getting us on the air then is sitting with me now, Dr. Rue Hill. He was WUWM's first general manager, and he served in that role from 1964 to 1976. Dr. Hill, it is such a pleasure to see you again. Thank you for talking with us on Lake Effect.
Well, it's my pleasure.
And happy 55th birthday, because without you, we would not be celebrating this momentous birthday.
That's a momentous way of putting it. I'm grateful. Thank you.
Well, it's true. You were the first general manager of this station. Take us back to that time. What was going on that made the university and you think that starting a public radio station was a good thing?
I think primarily because I'd been involved with educational stations from my first years before the war at the University of Minnesota. And then during the war, I ended up in the Air Force programming a radio station wireless on a Air Force base. And then to Beloit College, which was talking about doing radio while I was a student there, and finally did. And when I came back to teach after the first stint of graduate school, I was the first manager of a public station that didn't get off campus. We were simply wired to the heating system for the whole campus. And then to Massachusetts to work with a colleague from college who happened to have been given a radio station. And he didn't like all the women on his staff. And he said, how do you do working with women? And I said, I've been married to one for several years, so I've had practice. And he said, good, you've got a job. So I managed first one and then a second AM station and then two FM stations on top at the same time while I was finishing a dissertation. But while at there, my boss decided he was going to sell the radio stations. It wasn't productive enough for him. But I looked in the market and learned that Syracuse needed a television production director and possible radio station manager, and to teach three courses and to be the alumni contact for all graduate students, because there were two programs. The bachelor's program had been the first offered in the country, so they said, and the graduate program, which was. And so I was teaching at both levels and doing television productions modestly, because we only had a 10-ton Dumont camera and rack-mounted lenses. And they said, look, as a matter of fact, we're asking the current manager of WAER to leave. Would you mind taking that over as one course load? And I said, I have a feeling it's going to be more than that, but yes, I feel qualified. Let's do it. So for the next several years, I was managing a station which became the first in a series of experimental network affiliates on the East Coast.
And when was this? Is early 60s?
In the late 50s.
Late 50s.
Early 60s. Very early 60s. Because we were starting talking then about possibilities of a national network. And wildly, perhaps even a national public broadcasting service. But there was massive objection in Congress and in the White House. But we had some very strong lobbyists and helpful friends and a clientele that recognized a need that we were describing. And things began to happen. So five of us gathered from five of those Eastern Radio Network affiliates, met in Madison to talk about the possibilities of a national network for radio. And though we thought probably, and this was in 1959, that it was inevitable, but would we live long enough to know what inevitable meant? And but figured it'd be at least another 10 years before there could be a national system for television and for radio publicly supported. Because that was a lot of money, they thought, for who's going to listen, who's going to watch. But finally, things began to happen. So WAER was one of the stations that was on the deck. And then I finished my dissertation, and Ohio University called and said, we'd like someone to chair a department and manage the radio and the TV functions. And I said, gee, I'm interested, but what do I do? Well, fly down for an interview to start, but it looks like a dunk deal to us. And so I said, well, how do I get to Athens, Ohio? And they said, take American to Columbus. We'll meet you there. We'll bring you home. So what met me was the university plane and a pilot and a co-pilot and two stewardi who ferried me to Athens. And it was a firm deal, and I said, okay, I'll talk about it with the family, and I'll get back to you. And I flew back home as the telephone rang. And it was an old friend from Wayne State who had now relocated to the University of Wisconsin-Madison as director of radio TV. His name was Lee Sherman Dreyfus. He said, I've been on a search committee because the regents have decided that Milwaukee is big enough and brawly enough and troublesome enough. It ought to have its own radio station, UWM. And they were amazed at Milwaukee and wondered what we do. Where do we start? And it started with a search committee, and they found me. And I said, well, I told Lee, I said, I've just accepted a position temporarily at Athens. And he said, tell the Athenians to go whatever, because you're coming here for interviews. So I interviewed and was offered three positions and one salary.
That sounds about right.
A third of me was to be director of radio TV and to put a radio station on the air as soon as possible, and television facilities, which could only be rudimentary, but please start them for us. And to teach two courses, and a third of you will be statewide, by the way, with the Extension Division, and helping with programming for the TV network, which is newly born. So I talked to the family about it, and they said, after all this, what's new? So yes, let's move to Milwaukee.
So WUWM went on the air September 9th, 1964.
A year later.
So it took you a year to get it.
From our arrival.
Okay.
So you can imagine the furor. So I met with more than 100, well, it's actually 106 UWM students, graduates and undergraduates. And the charge was, we've got to put a radio station together and program it and staff it and keep it on the air. And many of those 106 stayed on with a number of very fascinating people that I've kept as friends since. So, let's see, 6 years after the station began in 64, the journalism department chair talked to me and he said, look, we're overdue at UWM. We should combine journalism and what you teach in radio, TV, and film. So what are we going to do about that? And I said, well, let's have lunch. And that was the first of many. And then with the dean, whom we had to do a sales job, and he thought it was a bully idea. So we became the Department of Mass Communication. And I said, Chairman Ken, you've done a beautiful job with journalism. How about starting out with a brand new department with a new name, Mass Communication? He said, one department at a time, if you don't mind, you be chair. So I chaired a department and decided that was the year that I should probably not be doing two administrative jobs and teach at the same time and keep a family. So I departed the station in 76 because another complication was that I'd become the secretary of the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association.
So there's a little conflict there, yeah. Well, now when did, for those who weren't around at the time, when did NPR become? Because you, at the beginning of the conversation, you said you had been talking right. about with your cohorts around right. the country about starting what eventually became NPR. I think WUWM came first, right? Was NPR even?
Oh, no, WUWM was first.
Yeah.
So we had our feet wet and had begun doing funding and supporting ourselves, not to the extent we should have, but now do. So we qualified after the original acceptance of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which was viewed by most as simply for television, because radio's already there. They're working. They're doing it. But we need public support for a national public radio service. So many of us lobbied Congress. I remember tromping the Senate building and needing a haircut. And I walked into the barbershop building, and a fellow came up and looked at me with a great smile, and he said, you look like one of my men. I said, from what state? And he said, Minnesota. I said, I think I know who you are. Hubert Humphrey, whom I saw again on the transit between buildings. And we became pen mates after that, which was fun.
So in the time from when WUWM started in 1964 and you left 12 years later to do other things, how had the landscape changed for public broadcasting, public radio in particular, but for public broadcasting? Were people becoming more accepting of it? Were they depending on it? Had that started yet?
Well, I think there was a pattern that happened. WHA, of course, had been the first and established itself, and others followed very quickly. And the state universities were able to do it first with capital and with large audience to master, and they did it.
When you look at what WUWM is now and the journey that it took to get there, are you surprised? Are you surprised by what we've become?
I try to be modest about it, but I'm so proud. It's just great.
You had hoped that that's what this would turn into?
One always has hope, but how do you define hope? What are its parameters? How far should you extend your imagination? But I knew our goal was solid, to be a community service, not just a university. What one of my faculty colleagues used to call the sandbox for kids who want to learn about radio. I downed him for that, but he repeated it endlessly anyway.
Well, I think that is one of the balances that probably due to your leadership, that it's certainly a university station. The university holds the license, but the community feels ownership of it.
Oh, yeah. And we could convey to the individuals that, look, now you're a professional. You're on the air. So watch your language and keep your voice in shape and mind your Q's and P's and your language, which reminds me of a story. We had Bob Reitman, originally on the air with a poetry show, and came to me and said, it's time we do something about rock. I'd like to do it. And I said, rock? And he said, no, come on, Doc. So I said, okay, let's do it. Let's do it. So he claims now that I created his career.
It's just interesting to think what the radio landscape was like in the 1960s, because I'm old enough to remember that, how it changed in the 70s, the advent of NPR when we started to get All Things Considered, and then Morning Edition in, what, 1980 or 81, whenever, 79, whenever it went on the air, and how things have shifted and changed just in my career in radio. And I think you must look back and think, how did we get here? This is really cool.
It really is. Well, with the proliferation of rock stations, all competing and all commercial, and yes, there was a lot of music, but there were a lot of commercials, until things began to drain out on the advertising side, given all the competing voices. So there was a place for serious talk and serious questioning and serious discussion, and we could provide it.
Now that you're long retired from this, do you listen still? Are you still one of our listeners?
Starting at 4:30 in the morning and during the day to find out what really happened, and at night when I check out.
Are you pleased with what you hear?
Always.
Terrific. Well, Dr. Hill, first of all, thank you for saying yes to that long ago invitation to let Athens go by the wayside and come here and start this, because none of us would be here without you.
I'm so pleased for all of you. Glad to have had a hand in it.
Dr. Rue Hill was WUWM's first general manager. We're celebrating our 55th birthday today. There is a $5,500 challenge grant on the table that will double your contribution today only. It is an online thing, so head over to WUWM.com to make your donation now to help us continue to bring you the news and information that you depend on. We wouldn't be here without Dr. Hill, and we certainly wouldn't be here without you. Thank you so much for 55 years of your support, and to many more to come. Coming up next, we'll fast forward the tape to the 1990s, when longtime WUWM Morning Edition host Bob Bach first started at the station. Bob joins us when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We are celebrating our 55th birthday today, and we are looking quite good, if I do say so myself. WUWM went on the air on this day in 1964, and before the break, we talked with Dr. Rue Hill, the station's first general manager and the man charged with actually creating the station and getting it on the air. We'll fast forward a few decades now. Our next guest will be a familiar voice to anyone who listened to WUWM from the early 90s until just a few years ago. During his 24 years with us, Bob Bach reported on the news, hosted the precursor of Lake Effect, and finished up his career as our local Morning Edition host and anchor, and he joins me now. Hey, Bob Bach, how are you?
I'm good.
I know. It's so great to see you.
Good to see
and
you,
And it has
too,
been
Bonnie.
A very long time since we have sat across the desk from
oh,
each
been,
other.
It's going on 5 years since
I
retired. I find that hard to believe.
I do, too, because it feels like it was just yesterday that you and I were on Morning Edition together.
Well, that's right.
Raising money.
Yeah, that's right. And we were good at that, I
we
must
were.
Say. Yeah.
We were.
It was an enjoyable form of radio because it represented a type of communication, really, that it breaks you out of the mold that we often function in. So I came to really enjoy the challenge of doing that, and it was particularly enjoyable to do it with you because of your effervescence.
And my enthusiasm.
That's right.
Yes. My willingness to go where no one else would go.
That's true.
So you're here to talk with us about, well, we're celebrating 55 years of Milwaukee Public Radio, Milwaukee's NPR, WUWM, and you were an integral part of a lot of those years. And so I kind of wanted to get an idea of how the news landscape has changed or did change in the time that you were working here. You know, what changed at WUWM? So I guess we should start with, when did you first start working?
Well, here in 1991. In some ways, there has not been a change in terms of how content is presented. It's still a long-form style of journalism, or what we would refer to as long-form. That is to say, it's longer than 45 seconds, and it's shorter than 6 minutes. So there's, you know, your story's going 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. In those early years, we did more documentaries, which might run 30 minutes. We did not have a Lake Effect show or its predecessor at 10, so there was no public affairs interview program. So some of these longer form presentations of information was done via multi-part series, mini documentary that might be 15 minutes, and then the 30-minute documentary on various subjects.
And so were those put into the morning show, or were they spread out throughout the day?
How? They would be both. They would be put in during the morning hours and then rerun oftentimes in the afternoon or on weekends. So they'd get 2 or 3 airings and really get some mileage. Now, interestingly, back then, this is almost impossible to believe, but there was no internet. So stories that aired basically went into the ether and disappeared. If you wanted to hear it again, you needed to buy a cassette copy of this thing. And there were no written transcriptions. So the internet has changed so much of how we distribute information, store information, make it available worldwide, that it's almost inconceivable to think of a time when it did not exist in terms of how much is out there and available to all of us, really.
Well, and when you started at WUWM, everything was on tape.
Right.
There was no digital.
No, no. It was actually a magnetic tape, quarter-inch wide, and it took quite a degree of skill to physically cut the tape and remove the piece that you did not want in there, whether it was someone clearing their throat or pausing for whatever it might be, and then joining the two pieces together so that you would have a coherent and efficient interview that was listenable without some of these other elements that would make it kind of uncomfortable to hear. But there was a skill in being able to cut tape and splice it together so it didn't make funny little noises whenever the splice would run over the playback head of the machine. Now, with electronic editing and computerized editing, that skill to be able to edit, physically edit tape, whether it was audio or video or both, is it's a wonderful memory. And it's absolutely useless.
Right. I mean, those of us who are old enough to remember the blocks and the razor blades,
right,
and the tape that you had to, and then you're trying to do it. And if you messed it up, you messed it up.
That's right.
There was no going back and undoing.
No, no. And so, oddly enough, if you put a piece of magnetic tape in upside down or backwards, whichever way you want to look at it, you mix it up, it comes out the English language spoken in reverse sounds much like Russian. So you would certainly end up with a piece of tape and go, what did I do? I need to have that 15 seconds of this person, and you couldn't find it. Oh, so those nightmares are fortunately a thing of the past.
What was the first job you did at WUWM?
Well, I was a news reporter or news producer, as we called them then. I also did a Saturday morning segment where I would take stories from the previous week, and for 1 hour we would replay those segments between 6 and 7, and that until morning edition began at or weekend edition at 7 o'clock. So I basically anchored a Saturday morning show, if such as it was, acting as the kind of continuity person to do the weather forecasts and string together other pertinent information for, I think it was, a 6-hour shift. So that combined with the reporting was really a fascinating experience. I I came up in radio as a disc jockey initially, which, again, a thing of the past. That was in 1975 in Merrill, Wisconsin, and then came to Milwaukee as a news and sports reporter at WISN Radio, and then came over here after 2 years at Channel 18 as a sports reporter. So news reporting that I encountered here was different from the standpoint that it was not just wham, bam, 30 seconds. It was longer form material that required additional voices, additional thoughts being placed into the story, opinions, whatever it might be. And really it was a fascinating learn on the job kind of situation that I really enjoyed.
When did you feel that you had kind of conquered that form, that longer form? How many years did it take you to feel comfortable there?
Probably about 4 or 5.
Yeah.
Fortunately, by the mid-90s, I was developing a sense of not only what stories really need to be told in terms of news and information, but also what stories would work on the air and the way in which they would work. You're not going to satisfy every story with a 30-minute documentary. In fact, you're going to bore the heck out of the audience. So sometimes the 3-minute story is the way to go. Sometimes it's a minute and a half. Other times you're in that 4 to 5 minute range. So that really required some learning and some finesse. And once that began to fall into place, it just seemed like the whole landscape of ideas opened up because there were so many possibilities, including environmental reporting, which became a complete fascination of mine and in some ways changed my life early on. And certain other stories that I just had a yearning to tell and was able to.
At some point in your career at WWM, you were sitting on this side of the table. It was at 10 at that point.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what was that like to shift from doing the kind of news stories you just described to doing a longer form interview?
Well, in some ways it was easier because it was easier to do interviews than it was to do long form stories because you didn't have the same element of compression. In other words, if you're doing a story that lasts 4 minutes, let's say, and you're going to have, generally speaking, 6 voices in there, and you may have 2 or maybe even 3 scenes, so the places where you're going to take the listener. There's an enormous amount of work that has to go into the presentation of those 4 minutes so that you captivate the audience sufficiently to get them to pay attention to the information that you believe and have deemed as important for them to hear. In many ways, it's like lifting weights with your brain. You really have to be on your toes to – there's not a second that's not important. And so that kind of pressure after a time can wear you out. Now, in the long-form interview, let's say you're going to go 10, 12, 15-minute interview, you need to – I learned you need to ask your best questions up front. Don't kind of fiddle around and, well, let's just warm up a little bit and I'll lob you a few. No, let's get right into it. And the mission, I thought, depending on the guest, of course, every guest is not – going to address a hard news subject. But those that are need to be challenged. The facts that they're going to use need to be questioned. And so therefore, you as the interviewer need to really know your stuff so that you'll be able to decipher when you're hearing something that you don't believe is accurate, and you'll be able to challenge this individual in a constructive way, not to create a kind of a combat situation or confrontation. No, that's not the idea. The idea is let's get to the truth and stay there and present as much information as we can in the allotted time. And that'll be a service to our listeners. We're not going to waste anybody's time. Now, if the interview is about a softer subject, here too, what background can you learn about the subject and the person, if it's an artist, for instance, as you would well know, that is going to make this interview the most enjoyable for the listeners? So it depends. Both the long-form interview and the tightly edited and written stories have unique challenges. I would say I found writing in that 4-minute window to be more challenging than doing the long-form interview.
The toughest right. thing to keep the story arc,
right.
as you say, compressed.
Exactly.
You know, and still informative and
right.
still engaging.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a key
yeah.
word.
Yeah. Yeah. Because otherwise, if nobody's listening to it, then why have you done
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah. That's right. Very true.
So in the time, how many years was it? 25?
Just 24. About,
yep. Yeah. How did the news landscape change, or did it, in Milwaukee?
Oh, it changed radically. I think the corporatization of radio that took place, AM radio, in the late 1980s with Cumulus and some of the other mega companies that began to buy stations, found, in my opinion, that it was far less expensive to provide confrontational talk between a host and listeners with a call scanner than it was to have a full-blown news department. There was just simply a better profit potential in downsizing news departments and allowing the public to have this open forum, if you will. And the thing that coincided with that, as best as I can tell, was the rescission of the Fairness Doctrine, which happened in the late 1980s. Now, the Fairness Doctrine required two things. One, that any person who would be spoken of, particularly in a negative fashion, would have an equal opportunity or equal time to respond to these accusations that were being made by another. And the other component of the Fairness Doctrine was that a radio station needed to provide a certain quality of content that was in the public interest. And this was a requirement of its license. Well, through a variety of circumstances, the greatest of which pivoted on the First Amendment, the Fairness Doctrine was done away with and seen as unnecessary and a hindrance to broadcasting. And so once it was removed, well, it was kind of open season on raw opinion that would go unchallenged. And the potential for individuals to be accused or lambasted or whatever the case may be.
Slandered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With no real opportunity to respond. So corporatization of radio, especially on the AM band, the proliferation of music on the FM band, thereby taking away what for many years had been one of the features of AM radio, which was music, and the Fairness Doctrine elimination, those put together changed not only the local landscape of news reporting on local radio, but also nationally.
And it seems like that was about the time that public radio really exploded because it filled that niche.
Oh, yes.
That had been eliminated by those things because people still wanted fair and accurate reporting.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And to this day, public radio and WUWM in particular, it's a beacon. And I mean, if you have a yearning to hear the real deal, this is where you want to listen. Of course, there are other sources too, but they primarily are related in some fashion to public broadcasting. I don't see a lot of high-quality journalism that's coming out of private broadcast or for-profit broadcast operations, certainly not to the degree when you compare it with the WUWM or others, and there are others right here in Milwaukee and in the state of Wisconsin for that matter, and they all provide just a remarkable service that can't be taken for granted. Thank goodness public radio exists, and thank goodness that we do have somewhere where we can tune every single day to get a dose of sanity and to get a dose of accuracy and objectivity, because especially now, these things are absolute requirements to good mental health.
Do you miss producing at all?
I do.
Yeah.
I miss producing stories. I don't miss the pressure that there was. The deadline pressure was very difficult to live up to, the last couple of years that I was working. I can tell you this, I think maybe the greatest fear that I had in producing, let's just call it a hard news story that would run between 3 and 5 minutes, was answering this question. Does this story end where it really should have begun? That was just a nightmare. Mm. In other words, have I just taken 4 minutes of a listener's time and told them stuff they already know? Whereas if I'd have started the story at this 4 minute mark, then I would have gone into areas that perhaps weren't as well known or would have been a lot more useful. So this is something that you dealt with every day. is trying to answer that question. Did this story just end where it should have started?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Every interview, everything is like, did we get the important right. things out of there, or did we just do the easy questions?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, Bob Bach, I miss you.
I miss you too, buddy. I really do.
This has been so great to be able to catch up with you and to celebrate 55 years of good public service with WUWM.
Absolutely.
And I hope you'll think about in your retirement, if you feel like you've got some writing chops left and you want to do a commentary or two for us, that you'll consider that.
I certainly will.
All right.
Thanks for inviting me.
Bob Bach worked in WUWM's newsroom from 1991 to 2015. In those 24 years, he reported, hosted an earlier version of Lake Effect called At 10, and was our morning edition host until he retired. We are celebrating 55 years today, and if you agree with Bob Bach that public radio is a beacon for anyone who wants to hear the real deal, please make a contribution today. We have a very generous $5,500 challenge grant on the table that will double your donation. It is an online thing, and it is good today only, so head over to WUWM.com to make your donation now to help us continue to be the beacon you depend on. We'll take one last break and then revisit one of our favorite interviews from our archives, a conversation with astronaut Scott Kelly. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Ground control to Major Tom.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. We are celebrating 55 years of being on the air today, and we hope you've enjoyed our show so far. We thought we'd wrap up with one of our favorite recent interviews, an onstage chat with astronaut Scott Kelly. Kelly set what was then an American endurance record when he spent more than 11 months aboard the International Space Station from 2015 to 2016. It was his third time aboard the space station after a career that also involved space shuttle flights. But on his third ISS mission, Kelly was himself a subject of a science experiment. Researchers were monitoring him in space while they also monitored his twin brother, Mark Kelly, on the ground. Kelly shared some insights on his mission while he was in Milwaukee 2 years ago to speak at the UWM Union.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for buying my book, and I think you will enjoy it. You know, it's great to be here. Actually, after a year in space, it's great to be anywhere with gravity. On the space station, I changed positions so many times, you would have thought I was running for president. That's just a joke. So to those of you in the audience here that do not appear to be space aliens, I'd like to say good evening. And to the rest of you, I come in peace. So I'm going to read a little bit from the book so you can hear it in my own voice. And I'm going to start where, not where Tom Wolfe told me to start, because he said begin at the beginning. I'm going to begin at the end, which is the prologue. Which doesn't make sense, but it actually starts in after I got back to my house after being in space for a year and flying back to the U.S. And I'll just read from this briefly, and then we'll start just like a discussion about the book and about my story. I'm sitting at the head of my dining room table at home in Houston, finishing dinner with my family, my longtime girlfriend Amiko, my daughters, Samantha and Charlotte, my twin brother, Mark, his wife, Gabby, his daughter, Claudia, our father, Richie, and Amiko's son, Corbin. It's a simple thing, sitting at a table and eating a meal with those you love, and many do it every day without giving it much thought. For me, it's something I've been dreaming of for almost a year. I contemplated what it would be like to eat this meal so many times. Now that I'm finally here, it doesn't seem entirely real. The faces of the people I love that I haven't seen for so long, the chatter of many people talking together, the clink of silverware, the swish of wine in a glass, these are all unfamiliar. Even the sensation of gravity holding me in my chair feels strange. And every time I put a glass or fork down on the table, there's a part of my mind that is looking for a dot of Velcro or a strip of duct tape to hold it in place. I've been back on Earth for 48 hours. I push back from the table and struggle to stand up, feeling like an old man getting out of a recliner. "Stick a fork in me. I'm done," I announce. You know, eventually I go to bed, and then when I wake up a few hours later, I actually wake up with flu-like symptoms, and then I write, "I struggle to get up, find the edge of the bed, feet down, sit up, stand up. At every stage, I feel like I'm fighting through quicksand. When I'm finally vertical, the pain in my legs is awful, and on top of that pain, I feel something even more alarming. All the blood in my body is rushing to my legs, like the sensation of the blood rushing to your head when you do a headstand, but in reverse. I can feel the tissue in my legs swelling. I shuffle my way to the bathroom, moving my weight from one foot to the other with deliberate effort, left, right, left, right. I make it to the bathroom, flip on the light, and look down at my legs. They are swollen and alien stumps, not legs at all. Any kids in here? Little kids? How old? Four? "Oh, shit," I say. "Amico, come look at this." You didn't hear that, did you? Anyway.
Thank you. Well, that actually, before we get to the actual book, that leads to a question that I have about the physical toll that year took on you. I mean, you describe in the book some experiments that you did with mice where, you know, you were studying, or scientists were studying, what was happening with muscle atrophy. And essentially, you gave your body to science before you were done with it by doing this mission. Was it worth it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was the not only the hardest thing I have ever done in my entire life, but the most rewarding thing. And that's why I wanted to do it. That's why I wanted to spend a year in space. So initially, I was not too enthused about the idea when it was brought up to me. I had just recently flown a 6-month flight, which I used to call a long duration flight, not anymore. But that's why I did it, because I knew it would be harder. And that's what, you know, that challenge excited me about the idea eventually.
Doing the hard things.
Yeah.
You talk about that in the book a lot.
Yeah.
About wanting to always do the hard things.
Well, it's not really about always wanting to do them, but it's more about like never turning them down. You know, and I always had this sense of, you know, mission that required me to say yes when I really didn't want to.
So why the book? Was that also a hard thing?
So when I got to space this last time, and it was the my fourth flight into space, I had flown 3 times previously. And because I was going to be on the space station for longer than any American had ever been in space, I thought, you know, this might be a good story for a book, right? Makes sense. And but then when I was kind of writing my own, or just thinking about like my life story and my path to being the guy on the space station for a year, I thought, you know, even going back to when I was a kid, this could be a story that really resonates with a lot of people, because it's not just a story about me being in space, which is kind of the framework of the book. It's also the story of this kid who, when I was younger, and the little kids in here, don't take this as a plan. This shouldn't be your life plan, because it was hard to recover from. But when I was a kid, I was a really bad student. And I was the kid that would be looking out the window or looking at the clock, trying to make it go faster than I ever did paying attention in school. It was absolutely impossible for me to do it. And I think if I was a kid today, I'd be the kid with, you know, ADD or ADHD. Then I basically meandered through my first 13 years of school, not being able to study. Graduated in the bottom half of my class, went to college. Actually went to the wrong college, though. And I don't mean like I went to this school thinking this one was a better fit for me. What I mean is I applied to and showed up at this school thinking I was going to this school over here. I'm quite possibly the only person to ever do this. And I get there, and I'm like, hey, when's the football game? Like, we don't have a football team. That's that other school in Maryland. And I was just basically doing the same thing I had always done. I couldn't pay attention. I wasn't doing my homework. Wasn't doing well. Eventually not even going to class very much. And then one day I walk into the college bookstore to buy like gum or something. Not a book. Not sure I had ever bought a book before. But I go into the bookstore and I see this book on the shelf on the end. It's got this red, white, and blue cover, and it had a title that looked really cool, and it showed like motion in a very positive direction. And I picked it up and I started, you know, looking in it, and I read the back. And I was interested enough in it that I took my gum money and purchased the book, took it back to my dorm room and laid there for the next few days on my unmade dorm room bed. And I read the stories about the fighter pilots that became the test pilots, that became the original Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts. And I recognized, you know, traits that these guys had in themselves, that how it was written in the book, that I could really relate to. I felt like I had in myself, with one exception. You know, I couldn't do my homework or pay attention or be a good student. And I thought, you know, if I could solve that problem, I could be just like them. And if it wasn't, and I know what you're thinking, you know, that's a giant leap, really. 18-year-old kid can't do his homework, decides that he's going to be, reads a book, decides he's going to become an astronaut. But really what it was a bunch of very small, manageable steps. And if I look back on that day, I was 18 years old, and I read a book that was my spark, that motivated me, inspired me to do something really, really challenging. 18 years later, almost to the day, I was flying in space for the first time, the first American in my class of 35 American astronauts to fly in space. And I think, you know, that's a really great story that might, you know, inspire some other people to do things that they might not think is possible.
You didn't start out thinking that this was going to be a path. So that was a long, hard 18 years to get to that first flight.
Well, I had a plan. And I didn't know if I was going to make it there. I had a backup plan, too. It's always good to have a backup plan. Maybe several.
Which was?
I was going to stay in the Navy, and I wanted to be the commanding officer, the captain of an aircraft carrier someday. You know, I didn't get to do that, but I got to be the captain of a more expensive ship. Much more expensive.
So what do you think, what traits do you think made you a good astronaut? What did they see in you?
Whew, you know, I'm not, part of the selection when you get picked is you need to be, you know, technically capable of doing the job. And in my case, I was a military pilot and test pilot. Wasn't the greatest pilot in the beginning. I know that's hard to believe. But I wasn't. You know, I think, you know, my brother says, you know, how we, you know, how we do something or how capable we are, you know, is no indication of how good we are when we start or something. I'm going to stop quoting him. It's anyway, so, you know, being a, you know, a test pilot in the military requires certain skills. And then you, you know, assuming you have those, you go interview. And then I think it's more of a, you know, NASA is more about, you know, who they think would be good teammates, who would they like to work with. And then being a successful astronaut, you know, once you get selected, I think is more of a matter of, you know, having, you know, the technical rigor to learn the systems and to operate them very, very precisely, very carefully. On the space shuttle, there are 2,000 switches and circuit breakers inside, some of which, you know, if you push one of these buttons at the wrong time, you can blow the thing up, you know, you and your crewmates along with you. And so technical precision is very important, but also for spending, you know, a long time on the space station. Certainly, you know, teamwork and being able to be isolated for a long time. And in some ways, I think even the ADD I think I have was kind of helpful, because I think I've always felt like one advantage I had over some of my crew members is that, you know, some really type A motivated people is they always have to do everything perfectly. And it was easy for me to just kind of let certain things go that I didn't think was as important and just focus on the really important stuff. And maybe, you know, ADD helps in that case.
You had that filter.
Yeah, I had the ability to just let go and say, hey, I know this is we're supposed to be doing this, but let's not spend all of our energy on it because, you know, we got all this other stuff to worry about that's more important.
One of the things you capture so well, at least I imagine, because of course I haven't been in space, but you talk about the tedium of it. And of course, I think all of us who grew up on watching Star Trek and other science fiction things, we have a much more romantic idea of what spaceflight is. But you talk about the timeline that just ticks along and that you have to meet, and that the repetitive tasks and things take all of your concentration, and there never seems to be a break. Mm-hmm. And did it feel as tedious as you were doing it? Because some of the times as I was reading this, I was thinking, oh my God, I don't think I could survive that.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, if Star Trek really had like microgravity, they would have a lot of tedious things they had to do too.
Right.
Because gravity helps so much in our lives. I mean, you have no idea. I mean, it just makes just about everything is easier to do, with the exception of like moving very, very heavy objects, or you know, putting yourself in a weird position. Like if you were trying to connect your like VCR, if anyone remember what a VCR is, connect your VCR to the TV. That weird position. That's easier. But yeah, it is a but partly due to that, it is a tedious routine, which to me in some ways made the days go by quick, because you're rushing from one thing to another. But the weeks seem to drag on.
You talked about counting up rather than counting down. And did that help?
And so what she's referring to is when I got on board the space station, my plan was to never count down the days remaining, because there were too many. And I had been given the advice of, when you do something like this, maybe you just want to count up, as if every day is something you've collected, an achievement, you know, like collecting baseball cards. You have more of them. I had more days in space. Now, unfortunately, my plan didn't work very well, because when we got to day 100, my Russian colleague, Misha, started telling me every day how many days we had left. And I guess, and he really didn't understand what I meant when I said, Misha, stop telling me that.
Astronaut Scott Kelly speaking on stage at the UWM Union with me 2 years ago. Kelly's book is called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. The full interview we had with him is available at WUWM.com. And that is also where you can make a donation to help keep WUWM on the air, on the web, and on whatever new technology we haven't even dreamed of for another 55 years. Remember, there's a $5,500 challenge grant available today only to help your contribution go even farther. Thanks so much for joining us as we've celebrated our 55th on-air anniversary today. Lake Effect returns again tomorrow at 10 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.